Hello and welcome to Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. This is episode number 2. That's due in Italian, dose in Spanish. And we're giving you a dose of Abbott and Costello today. How did you like that segue? Was that something? Oh, boy. Sign this kid up.
We're off to a great start.
So today we are going to be looking at where we brought them in the last podcast. We brought them right up to the cusp of their movie fame. They're signing with Universal Studios, who decided to put them into a film, a rather ambitious film for Universal Studios, which was considered an A-minus studio. They were putting together a big time musical. They had signed Alan Jones. Now, those of us who love the Marx Brothers know Alan Jones from two movies they made at MGM, A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races. And at this point in his career, MGM had given him the old heave-ho, and Universal decided to give him a two-picture contract. The first one was based on the Rodgers and Hart hit Broadway musical, which was based on Two Gentlemen from Verona. The Shakespearean play. And what was it called? I forget what it was called. Ooh, boy, this is terrible because it's so famous. And I'm a big Rodgers and Hart fan. Joe Penner is in it. Martha Ray, Irene Hervey, who was married to Alan Jones at the time. Are you looking that up, Jerry?
I'm looking that up. We can edit long. This out.
I really do. I just got through telling Jerry I did all these notes and I have all these facts and now I can't think of the stupid musical. But it was the first one he did.
That movie was called The Boys from Syracuse.
That's it. The Boys from Syracuse. Yep. Thank you so much. I was nowhere near it, by the way. So thank you for looking it up. And for the second one, they enticed him with Jerome Kern. Now, Jerome Kern was the granddaddy of early 20th century Broadway musicals. You would never see a revival of an early Jerome Kern musical because they're like, you know, they're called things like Boom Boom, you know, there's like no plots to them or anything like that. So that didn't happen until later when he hit on a very major change in theater. He was the main power behind Showboat. He wrote some of his best songs, and it was, people say that Oklahoma was the first musical to actually incorporate songs that move the story along, but I beg to differ. I beg to differ that it was Showboat. And back
You're
in 1927,
right.
Yes. 18,
right.
A full 18 years before, or no. Of 18, 15 years, whatever. You want to hear something funny? I sent a link of our last podcast, episode 1, to Matthew Conium in England. And
yes.
and he's still not on the show. So I don't think we're going to be graced with his presence anytime soon. But I want to tell you something about my personality, just so you know this. I sent him the podcast, and after listening to it again, I realized that I made this horrible mistake. I kept referring to Kate Smith's producer as Ted Post, when in fact his name was Ted Collins. And if you know old-time radio, he was very big, you know, producing the Kate Smith show and actually managing her career. And I actually wrote back to Matthew and said, by the way, I just want to apologize. I said Ted Post instead of Ted Collins. And he wrote back the most sarcastic response. Well, I never want to speak to you again. You're a pariah in my eyes. So that's the way I am. I just hate when I make a mistake. Yeah, but you make them, right?
What do
you
mean? Oh, yeah.
We're talking about the movie. Coming up, by the way, we're talking about it and we didn't say what it is. It's Abbott and Costello's very first film. It's called One Night in the Tropics. It was referred to by two of the stars of the movie, Peggy Moran and Robert Cummings, as One Night in the Flopics. because it didn't do very well. Well, we'll get around to that. We'll get around to all of that. But we're talking about Jerome Kern and his involvement in this. Now, he was a major, major, major name, a hero of people like George Gershwin and Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. I mean, as far back as that, they all looked up to Kern. If you're a fan of the American Songbook, just think about the songs from Showboat, Old Man River, you know, Fish Gotta Swim, Birds Gotta Fly, I've Got to Love One Man Till I Dye My Hair Blonde, or something like that. And then there's A Fine Romance, A Fine Romance with No Kisses from the Fred and Ginger movie. And then there's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which had several lives as a hit song. Mm-hmm. The Way You Look Tonight was his Academy Award winning song. And then there's Long Ago and Far Away from Cover Girl, and a song considered to be one of the best ever written by people who love the American Songbook, All the Things You Are. When all the things you are mine. Anyway, that's for all of you old-time song people, of which I count myself as one. So he had quite the pedigree. So coming into this, you know, Universal was quite happy. But we're talking about 3 years before this, 1937. They were planning a movie, this movie, and it was called Riviera at that time. Kern had written these songs with lyricist Dorothy Fields, who is the daughter of, you know, Weber and Fields.
Oh, they yes.
Often compared to Abbott and Costello, interestingly mm-hmm. enough. In fact, they did some of the same material only 20, 30 years before.
Yeah.
But so Abbott and Costello weren't the only ones doing old material, because this was an old project being brought up to date. Now, let's talk about the project itself. It's called One Night in the Tropics, the Universal Incarnation, but it's based on a story written in 1914 by Earl Der Biggers. And Jerry, what was his big claim to fame?
Oh, my goodness. He was the son of Earl Der Smallers.
Only after they put him in the dryer.
You've stumped me on that one.
Oh, okay. I'll give you a hint. Charlie Chan. Oops, I gave it away.
okay, let me think then. He wrote the Charlie Chan stories.
Wait, you got it. Oh, that's incredible that you got that. Incredible. Boy, you know, I don't know why everybody says you're so dumb. Yeah. You're supposed to, now 10 minutes later, you're supposed to say, who says I'm dumb? All right. For you F Troop fans out there.
Oh, yes. Trust me, I was planning on waiting for 10 minutes and then responding to that.
I don't doubt that somehow. I don't doubt that. Okay, so we're getting back to the story was called Love Insurance, which, you know, of course, plays into this entire story. And it was filmed twice before. I don't know if you knew that, Jerry.
No, I didn't.
No, Paramount owned the rights to this story in 1919. It was made into a movie called Love Insurance, starring Bryant Washburn and Lois Wilson. Oh, and then course. Universal bought it. Yeah, you know them. They used to hang around with Earl Derb Smallers. and then Universal bought this project in 1924. They made another film based on that story called The Reckless Age. And it starred a guy that old movie fans know, Reginald Denny, British actor, mm-hmm. was a star in The Silence. In fact, he had an entire series of comedies, short comedies of his own. Funny guy. I remember him in the Buster Keaton movie, Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath. He was very good in that. Very good.
Yes.
He's good in everything. Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. He's the architect. He's so good. He's so good. Anyway, so he was in the earlier incarnation of this story. Now let's discuss the story itself. Jerry and I both watched this film separately, but last night we both watched the film just to, you know, to familiarize ourselves with it for this podcast. The story. It's very.
You approach this with great reluctance, I can tell.
I want to get Earl Der Biggers on the phone and ask him what the hell this thing is about. Interestingly, when they first started showing this film in the New York area when I was growing up, I had never seen it before. I had only read about it in Jim Mulholland's book came out afterwards. But when I first saw the film, it began with a cut. And whereas the real film begins with Robert Cummings and Alan Jones walking down the street and then encountering people as they do, and then getting into a fight with the cops and all this, and he goes before the judge. I mean, this was all cut out.
Really?
The movie began when Robert Cummings had already bumped into Mary Boland, the aunt, and all this stuff. You didn't see any of this. It was just him on the phone trying to apologize to Cynthia. And then Alan Jones comes up with the love insurance idea. That's how the movie began. Interestingly, that's how the movie was. Because when it was reissued, they cut all that stuff. They wanted to put it as part of a double feature. So they cut all that stuff, like 15 minutes, and released a 69-minute version. And it was only a few years later that they found a complete print at the British Film Institute. Thank God for the British Film Institute, I'm telling you.
Yes.
They're the ones who came up with that Animal Crackers complete version. So anyway, yeah, we have the complete version of the film now. And it's some of my favorite stuff in the film, actually. I love the scene with Kathleen Howard as the judge.
Yes.
She's incredibly nice and so not what she was with W.C. Fields in It's a Gift and Man on the Farm Trapeze. Ah, hello, dear. How are you? Shut up, you idiot. Ah, yes, dear.
Well, yeah, watching her in that scene, you know, putting the police officer in his place as he's trying to do his job.
He is, and he has a black eye.
Yeah, and she's falling under the spell of Alan Jones.
So. Right, with his wavy hair. But anyway, so this all happens. And it's interesting because in that opening scene, you really get the relationship between Alan Jones and Robert Cummings. They're best friends. You know, they get into trouble together. They chase women together. You know, they're that kind of people. And I don't know if you noticed this, but when they stopped to talk to some of those people, one of them was a guy by the name of Tyler Brooke. This fascinates me because he was a name in silent films of the 1920s. He made a lot of comedies, and then he starts showing up in early talkies and musicals. He does a great bit in Trouble in Paradise for Ernst Lubitsch, many other things. But in this movie, he is filmed from the back. And he's on screen maybe 30 seconds and even has a line of dialogue before he moves on or they move on. It's sad. It's really sad. This guy had a real career. And I'm thinking that since the director was an old silent guy, he working at Max Sennett originally, Eddie Sutherland, the director, he had that whole career in the silence. He co-directed or was an assistant director with Chaplin on Woman of Paris. So I'm thinking that he threw his buddy a bone at that point, you know, and about 3 years later, he was dead from a suicide, carbon monoxide poisoning. So things were not going well for Tyler Brooke. But boy, this is fun, huh? Boy, we really lifted up spirits with that story. That's another thing, folks. I'm morbid. I'm completely morbid. If it has to do with the truth, I tell it. I don't care if it's morbid or sordid or any of those other words with OR in the middle.
I think isn't that the title of your proposed autobiography, Morbid and Sordid?
Actually, it's called The Morbid, the Merrier, I call it.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. but anyway, so yeah, so now we have the opening of the movie. So here's the plot. This is what the entire plot hinges on. Alan Jones is a very eccentric insurance dealer, I would say, right? Eccentric. Off the beaten path. He insures anything. You know, you give it to him, he'll insure it. So he comes up with an idea. Robert Cummings in this movie is engaged to Cynthia, a beautiful, young, rich lady, obviously, with an aunt played by Mary Boland, who you remember the year before from The Women. Oh, toujours l'amour, very funny lady. She plays her aunt, and the aunt hates Robert Cummings because of an altercation that happened, an accident. They kept bumping into each other and whatever. So Alan Jones is listening to this conversation between Robert Cummings and Nancy Kelly, who plays Cynthia. She looks really beautiful in this film, doesn't she? They really
photographed her
gorgeous. So anyway, he's very insecure about this engagement because the aunt hates him and, you know, whatever. All these screwball comedy things tend to be the same. But Alan Jones comes up with the idea for love insurance. He's going to marry Cynthia. If he doesn't marry Cynthia, he gets paid off, right? Yeah. So his company can't cover the entire $1 million policy. So he goes to a guy he knows who runs a local gambling casino and nightclub, Roscoe, who's played by William Frawley, our dear friend who played Fred Mertz on I Love Lucy and Bub on My Three Sons, among many other things. He shows up in Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, in fact. He's a great foil to the boys. So he gets Roscoe, William Frawley, to underwrite half of the million. So there's a lot at stake here. Roscoe's kind of a gangster. And if things don't happen the way they're supposed to, he kind of makes a threat to Alan Jones saying this better work. And to make sure it works, he introduces him to the boys, to his two henchmen, who just happen to be named Abbott and Costello, coincidentally.
Son of a gun.
Go figure. And interestingly, since Abbott and Costello were basically known nationally at this point as radio comedians with their own sound. And when I say that, I think last week we talked about this, that they thought that Bud and Lou sounded too much alike. So they told Lou to pitch his voice much higher, and it's very obnoxious. I don't know how he did it. He did it for like 3 years, and I can't believe that he did.
Yeah.
But you hear it in the movie because they're off camera. And this is very clever. We hear them before we see them, and the audience, I'm sure, in 1940 said, ah, there they are, you know, the Kate Smith Show. Or at this point, they were Fred Allen's Summer Replacements, because this movie was shot in August into September. So you hear, Costello, what are you doing? Oh, I'm a bad boy. All that stuff. He says, I'm a bad boy 3 times in this movie. And to me, it's 3 times too many.
Yes.
We all know the power of a catchphrase, correct? We all grew up with Saturday Night Live. And then radio was full of them. You know, you had Jerry Colonna, greetings, Gate. You know, let's oscillate. You had Who's Your Hootie. You had, I mean, I can go on and on. Durante with Umbriago. Everyone had a catchphrase. And Lou's was, I'm a bad boy. The other one was, hey, Abbott, his yell. But anyway, he really uses I'm a bad boy in this one. And he carries it over into Buck Privates, the next film. And I think that's the last time he uses it, thankfully.
I think so. In the films, yes. You know, in their radio series that went on for a number of years, it pops up now and again. But yeah, in the films, I'm pretty sure that was it.
Yeah, they used to begin their radio show with the announcer, Ken Niles, saying, you know, introducing, and blah, 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 he was known to say, and then Lou would say, I'm a bad boy. And then that went away, and it became, and he was heard to say, hey, Abbott, which I much prefer.
Yes.
Much more welcome to me, you know. But the I'm a bad boy thing, it ran its course and became very old. And it was part of his old characters. It's part of that radio character that I just never took to, you know, that high voice guy. But Lou's radio character was different from his film persona. They made him sort of a Charlie McCarthy type wise guy, woman chaser, different. A real wise guy, an insult comic. It's interesting. But most of radio, if you look at most of radio comedy, it was insult humor. You know, that was the main source.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, it's extremely prominent in most radio comedies. Yeah.
Yeah. Think about it. I mean, you know, in fact, a lot of it is just based on insult humor back and forth. But the Abbott and Costello Show was very, very big on insult humor. I preferred their second series, by the way. We'll get into the radio series in future podcasts, but I preferred their ABC series which was transcribed and edited and all that stuff. It's much cleaner, and they're not relying on old material and Joe Miller joke books. Really, which is what it's like. So anyway, we meet Abbott and Costello, and
finally,
I got to tell you, I want to hear your impression of first seeing them. You know, because I do this. You can't watch movies from the past with a modern perspective. You just can't. It's not fair to the film. So I always put myself in the place of the audience watching the film for the first time. So what did you think watching The Boys on camera for the very first time?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, why did it take so long? That was my first impression, especially since they get third billing in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was Alan Jones and
Nancy Kelly.
Thank you, Nancy Kelly. And then Abbott and Costello before Robert Cummings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're prominent in the credits of the film. And so, yeah, it takes quite a while to get to them finally. Mm-hmm. But to me, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, the whole radio introduction, you know, hearing them before you see them just paved the way beautifully.
Yes.
And then I thought, well directed, when we do see them, it's a two shot right there at the table, and they go through two or three very rapid fire of their routines.
And they look dynamite. They look dynamite.
They do.
They're wearing tuxedos, you know. Seeing Lou in a tuxedo, it's kind of like, you know, we're used to the baggy suit, you know.
Where's the derby, you know?
or even the upturned fedora, you know.
Yeah.
And Bud looks great. I mean, Bud eschewed any kind of toupee at this point. It's his natural hair. And I think it makes him look great. He looks like a hawk.
Yes.
He looks like a regal bird. But anyway, they are just on fire. They're dynamite, you know. I think in the book I said they're the 1940s rolled into two people, you know.
Yes.
Who just exploding with comedy. But the whole thing, they do some of my favorite bits at the table. Two tens for a five. Take a number from one
take
to ten.
Number.
Oh. And Lou calls, you know, the close-ups of him when he realizes he made the mistake. In interviews, he calls that the skull, you know, the skull. Whenever I realize that I've made the mistake, that's the skull. That's where the people laugh, you know. So even this funny little guy, he was looking at it scientifically, which is what comics tend to do, you know.
Yes.
Because it is like a science.
Well, that's comedy. It's mathematics. It's timing. Mm-hmm. It's knowing the beats. It's, you know, playing the reaction of the audience. And when you don't have an audience, like in a film, it just becomes second nature if you've had a lot of stage experience, as they had at this point.
Yes.
That the delivery, the timing, the knowing how long to hold it, it is a science, as you say. And he just does it beautifully.
Oh, he's a natural. He was a natural from the very beginning.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I take away is that, my God, they were only on film once before. And that was the, some newsreel footage, at the premiere of Boys from Syracuse. So that was the very first, but this was their first doing comedy really on film. And their timing is born of the stage. It's just gorgeous. And those close-ups, the close-ups that they chose at the time are just laugh-inducing. You know, when you get a close-up of Lou and then he realizes that he just handed over $20 for $5, it's very, very funny. I find it interesting that Lou has all the wallets. He stole, there's like, he has like 100 wallets in his thing. And it's more Harpo than Lou.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then
Well, to me, it's between that, you know, the fact that he's the one that's been lifting all the wallets from everyone. Mm-hmm. And then the going back a step, the interchange with Bud about the money, the handing off. It's hard to describe this bit because it's a visual bit. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, gives Bud the money, but then takes it right back again. And then Bud insists on it. And he
put it in my hand and keep it there.
Takes it right back again. And just, it's the wonderful moment of Lou putting something over on Bud. And you don't see that very often.
Right, right. My favorite version of this, well, first of all, it's hard to top this because they're just so fresh and so eager to please. It's just wonderful. But 20 years later, is it 20 years later? No, 10 years later, sorry. Okay. Boy, that's quite a difference. 10 years later, they do the same bit in Meet the Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And they add to it. They add to the bit, which is nice. Lou puts his pocket over, so Bud thinks he's putting it in his own pocket, and he's putting it in Lou's. And, of course, we're all in line with Lou because he's looking at us the whole time.
Yeah. and that's another Harpo move.
Yes. Yes, you know, it is.
Sticking his pocket out there to receive whatever the guy's trying to put into his own pocket.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. In fact, I think he does it in Coconuts in the very first one.
Yeah.
But Bud and Lou are introduced, and they're gangsters. They're henchmen, and they're very funny. They're very funny. Their energy is just so. I mean, we watched the movie last night, okay? And I came away with a few things. Watching the actual plot, watching the screwball comedy musical aspect of it, what Universal wanted us to like. You know, I gave that a chance. And to tell you the truth, I laughed out loud a few times. There were a few moments with, I thought Leo Carrillo was completely wasted. He didn't have anything to do. That corny thing with his name, with all the Los Angeles street names, you know, Sepulveda, yes. La Brea, La Cienega. but he really doesn't have much to do. Mary Boland, on the other hand, she's just a treasure. She is just incredible. She was a big Broadway star in the 20s. In fact, there was something she did with a very young Humphrey Bogart, who was the male ingenue, you know, tennis anyone? You know, he would come in with the tennis racket. But she was a funny, funny lady. And she was, for years, she was under contract at Paramount, where she made a series of comedies with Charlie Ruggles. Mm. And they made a terrific pair because she was so overbearing and he was such like a little rabbit. They made a terrific, terrific pair. And then all of a sudden, she was out of Paramount. She did that one shot at MGM, The Women, which made quite an impression. It still does to this day. People think of her in that film. But she's very funny in this movie, and she has one of the funniest lines, I think, on Shipboard with Charlie Hall.
Yes. Yes.
It's so great to see Charlie Hall, you know, even getting dialogue, you know, in this film. And if you don't know Charlie Hall, folks, if you're a Laurel and Hardy fan or a Hal Roach fan, I should say, Charlie Hall was one of the major supporting players. He was, I have a buddy, we call him the Pit Bull. he was dangerous. He was usually at the other end of the horrible things that happened, you know, to Laurel and Hardy. But he shows up here as a ship steward and he has a line. He's told early on in the scene to go get some almonds.
Yes.
And some things happen that drive Mary Boland crazy. And he walks up to her and says, "You're nuts, madame." And she says something like, "I certainly am." And he looks at the camera like it's a Hal Roach short. That's all Eddie Sutherland. That's Eddie Sutherland, who comes from that world. So I love that line. I just thought that was a nice moment to give to give an old trooper. You know, he shows up in the Abbott and Costello show in the second season, the one where they're putting up the antenna on the roof.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. I think it's one of his last actual film appearances. He also shows up on a You Bet Your Life episode with Groucho.
That I did not know.
Yeah. There's photos of it. In fact, I think if you put in, if you Google it, and a photo might come up.
Okay. So
we met Abbott and Costello. I don't know about you, but I preferred Mickey, Peggy Moran.
Yes.
What a cutie pie. I mean, I've been in love with her since I was a little kid watching this film. She is just cute as a button. And she sings a halfway decent song, Remind Me. Da, 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 da. There are a few songs in this movie, I think, that are memorable. But for the most part, minor memorable. Not exactly, you know, standards. Let's put it that way. I found it very interesting that Jerome Kern absolutely hated Abbott and Costello. Was so angry that they were in the film. And I'm just thinking, he must have been apoplectic reading the reviews because they got the only good reviews of the movie. So he must have been, you know, pretty annoyed at that point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay. So we've got Love Insurance. Cynthia decides to leave Robert Cummings and go to San Marcos with her aunt due to Mickey, who is Peggy Moran, who is in love with Robert Cummings and will not let him marry Cynthia. Is everyone following this? she keeps Robert Cummings from making the ship to San Marcos. So she is there. She's on the ship with her aunt and Alan Jones, who has to make sure this goes through. Otherwise, his company has to pay $1 million. So as they're on the ship together, I think he finds himself falling in love with Cynthia, which is rather inconvenient. They get to San Marcos and they're introduced to Rodolfo, the bullfighter. Why is there always a Rodolfo in these movies, you know?
It's an unwritten rule of Hollywood in the day. I'm convinced. It's
just this threat, this Latin threat, you know, that hits the American. So anyway, they're there in San Marcos. And that's when one of my favorite lines in the movie is when you see that they're supposed to take Mickey to Kansas City. And yes, get her out of the way. That's what William Frawley tells Broden Lou. Take her to Kansas City. Get her out of the way. Okay? So the next thing you see, they're in the back of a car, and there's nothing but palm trees, and it almost says, welcome to San Marcos. And Lou is looking around, and he just says, I don't know. I just get the feeling we're not in Kansas City. This isn't Kansas City. Yes. It's really funny. So, and then they take the time. Now, this is interesting. I want to question you on this.
Okay.
Because Matthew Cunningham and I disagree on this routine. Jonah and the whale.
Yes.
When they're in the back of the car, they're on either side of cute, perky Peggy Moran, who eventually married director Henry Koster and retired and just got out of it and lived a very happy, long life. But anyway, they do one of their staples, one of their bits that they've repeated on. They did it in two more films. They did it on every television show. They did it on radio. Jonah and the Whale. Yeah. Now, this is where Lou tells Bud that I have a joke. I wrote it myself, and I don't need you to help me. And of course, that's Bud's cue to interrupt every 5 seconds to drive him crazy. And then, of course, reveal the punchline at the end.
Yeah.
Making him look like a complete moron. Now, I'm not a huge fan. What I admire about it is, and I talk about it in the book, their acting skills. It's a joy to watch them go through their paces. Although I don't think the routine is quite as funny as I would like it to be. My point about it, and I'm going to ask you about this, Jerry, right after this, but my biggest point about it is if Bud had a funnier punchline at the end, instead of sitting on the stool selling apples three for a nickel, it's not funny. You know, it's not really a funny joke. If they had a funny joke, I just think the bit would have been that much more dear, you know? What's your opinion on this, Jerry?
Okay, well, in the interest of keeping this interesting, I'm going to disagree with you.
oh, well, that's it. Forget
it. We're done. All right.
No, go ahead.
I personally think it is a weak punchline. Yes, I agree with you there. But I think that's what helps to sell it, that it's not a good joke.
Mm-hmm.
And this incarnation of the routine is my least favorite. I vividly remember them doing it in Here Come the Coeds,
yes,
and on the TV show. And mm-hmm. for me, what really sells the end of the bit is the fact that Lou exits, that slow walk out. And yeah. Bud's right behind him saying, well, what is it? What's the punchline? Come on, finish your joke.
We all enjoy it. Yeah.
The fact that they're stuck in the backseat of a car, though, it doesn't really have that ending. Well, you can't go anywhere.
Well, let me tell you this then, or let me suggest this, because this is something I enjoy. One of the reasons I really enjoy this version of the sketch is that Peggy Moran is actually really enjoying herself. And I watch her. Yeah. I watch her go back and forth, you know, and she became close to Lou. They became, you know, buddies on this shoot. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting for me to watch her watch him. And again, just like everyone says, she says, and less so with Bud. Bud kept to himself. That damn epilepsy. I just think he lived in fear his whole life, that poor man. Anyway, so yeah, that routine is one they do more than most. And I don't know, there's just something about it that I think if that punchline were better, I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm wrong. Who knows? Who knows? It really doesn't matter. So anyway, they're in San Marcos and they meet Rudolfo, who's a threat. And they even go to the bullfight to watch Rudolfo. And the girls love his cute little pants. Don't you just love his cute little pants? And of course, that ends in a big rainstorm. But so let's get to the finish here. So it turns out everybody shows up in San Marcos to make sure that this marriage goes. Now, I have to tell you, for the very first time, I totally understood this movie. I've seen it maybe, I don't know, 15 times, maybe more. And this is the first time I'm understanding it fully, because I looked at a close-up of the insurance policy, and it tells you what makes it null and void. And if Robert Cummings were to marry somebody else, that would make it null and void. So that's why at the end, when Mickey finally gets him to marry her, that's it. It's over. So Cynthia is free to marry Alan Jones, and Abbott and Costello get the final joke. They get the fade out, which is quite telling.
It is. And I vividly remember the very first time I saw this movie. The story is wrapped. We're going into the fade out. Music is playing. One more look at these two guys, and they tell this joke that they reuse at least 3-4 times through the rest of their career.
Oh, my, three or four times. My God. Well, quite a few more times than that.
Yeah. But yeah, the fact that they've got it, which to me just adds to that whole third billing in the opening credits. It really is their movie in that
Universal smelled success. They definitely smelled success. These guys were definitely worth looking into and continuing along with. Very funny stuff from Alan Jones, who had in his deal with Universal, he had script approval, he had director approval, and he had, was it cast approval as well? Anyway, he was the big wheel on this movie. Yeah. When they asked him about Abbott and Costello joining, he had seen them in Streets of Paris on Broadway, and he thought they were brilliant. And he said, sure. And they said, yeah, we just want them in for one routine. And he said, sure, one routine? Great, fantastic. And then one day he was in South America in the back of a car driving, and he saw a big billboard saying, Abbott and Costello in One Night in the Tropics. With his name nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, by the way, there's a new, there's an episode of the Bud Abbott variety show that I believe that I forgot to mention. And I had promised somebody, I got a few requests to do another Bud Abbott show. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, everybody's favorite variety host, Bud Abbott. Yeah. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. Thank you. Ah, what a beautiful audience. All right. I'd like to introduce my next guest. He's a wonderful actor. You've seen him a million times. Please welcome Burt Mustin.
Yay! Oh, thank you, Mr. Abbott. I'd like...
Quiet! What are you saying? You talk sense!
But Mr. Abbott, my friend...
What are you talking about? Get him out of here! What are you, crazy or something?
But Mr.
Get out of here!
Anyway, that's a clip that we got from the Bud Abbott Variety Show.
Okay. As a little... you know, workshop commentary, what have you, on the art of writing. I knew exactly what was coming. I knew exactly where you were going to go with it. I knew exactly how you were going to end it. But the fact that it was Burt Mustin, Oh my gosh, I lost it completely.
For those of you who don't know Burt Mustin, look him up and this will make perfect sense.
Oh boy.
So we should tell them the joke that closes the movie. He says, he looks at Alan Jones kissing Nancy Kelly and he says, oh, yes, he's going to make a wonderful husband. You don't even know what a husband is. A husband is what's left of the sweetheart after the nerve has been killed. That's the joke.
Fade to black right there. Fade yes.
And we used it quite a bit. And to be honest, it never fails. That joke always gets a laugh. Yeah. You know, when they use it live, it always got a laugh. And it is. It's a clever joke. Mm-hmm. I can see them using it in burlesque, you know, constantly. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what ends the film. Now, we were a couple of things we were going to talk about here. Number one, there's a song in this movie. It's a beautiful setting for a Universal film, really. Mm-hmm. It's quite elaborate, this film.
It is. It is.
The amount of extras during that finale, the farandole.
Yes.
There must be 1,000 people there. I think Carl Laemmle's family was out in full force. Oh, no, they were gone by then. But anyway, it's out in the moonlight, out on a balcony. The moon is shining. The palm trees are swaying. The ocean is in the background looking calm and gorgeous. Diamonds, you know, it looks like diamonds shining down. And he sings a song about being a clam and crawling into his shell. It has nothing to do with love or romance or moonlight or atmosphere. It has to do with climbing back into my shell. And it sounds like, you know, a something they threw away from Showboat for some reason. And we were going to play some of this for you. In fact, why don't we do that now? And you could hear, if you had to describe something that was not a love song, this would be it.
No sense in grieving, we had an even break all along. Don't crave no Swanee, Frankie and Johnny, downhearted song about me doing you wrong. Back in my shell, my evening paper in hand, I'll just sit and expand. I give you air, as of tonight you is free. I give you air, before you give her to me. A happy man I'm gonna be, socially, baby, I'm through. How do you do? And farewell, because I'm crawling back in my shell.
Now, what kind of a song is that to sing to a lady in the moonlight?
The only safe kind.
Safe.
Okay, so that song is just ridiculous. It's just crazy. But they actually justify it with that little dialogue at the end, which I think is...
What makes it even more ridiculous for me is when they come into the scene before he even starts singing the song, they're carrying like souvenirs. They've been on visiting the village, what have. She's got a sombrero she's carrying. He has an alligator. It's like a petrified alligator, full extension. He's holding it by the tail, and it's over his shoulder. It took me about 3 minutes to figure out what the heck it was that he was carrying. And he sets it down on the table as they sit there, and she even makes a comment about it. So, yeah.
I didn't even notice, to be honest with you.
Yep.
Oh, boy, but now I'm going to, believe me. Wow. An alligator. Okay. Yeah. It was probably one of those stuffed alligators that you see in those horrible shops.
Oh, yes.
That sell too much topaz and all that stuff. So, okay. So there's that. And then what's considered to be their second most popular routine, other than Who's on First, of course, is the mustard routine. Now, I'm going to ask you, Jerry. It's not my favorite. It's not my second favorite. My second favorite is 7 times 13 is 28. I just think that's brilliant. But this one would have to be third or fourth, I think, down the line. What do you think about the mustard routine?
I do enjoy it. here, and where it shows up in Noose Hangs High, I believe. They do again there. And I like it mostly because of the give and take. You know, at one point, Abbott's obviously in control, but then Lou takes control of the conversation. And Abbott is very much, well, that's not what I meant. Well, you know.
That's right. Lou is outraged.
Calm down. But then Bud comes back in on the top of it. And it's just good back and forth. Good give and take.
Yeah. And good acting. Yes.
Good acting. There we go. And I also would not put it number two. That's maybe fourth or fifth in my opinion.
Yeah, me too. But yeah. What would you put number two?
365 days.
Oh, that is a wonderful, wonderful routine. We have that for our listeners today, don't we?
Yes, we do.
So we're going to play that for you. This is where Lou is fired from his job. And conveniently, he only makes a dollar a day. I don't know who his agent is, but looking into other areas, other agencies. Yeah, so he wants his $365 for the year. And Bud has other ideas, doesn't he, Jerry?
Oh, yes.
Certainly. Why don't we listen to 365 Days, otherwise known as Paid in Full.
A fine mess you got us in. You're fired.
All right, then I'm fired.
You're fired.
I quit. Give me my money.
What money?
The money you owe me for my salary.
All right. Don't get excited.
I'm supposed to get a dollar a day, you know. I work for you 1 year. That's 365 days equals $365. Give me that $365 and I'll get out. I'll abdicate.
Now, wait a minute. Not so fast. How many hours a day did you work?
8 hours a day.
And how many hours are there in a day?
Don't try to put anything over on me, will you, Abbott?
What do you mean?
Look, there's 24 hours in a day, all but February, which has 28.
All right, that's right. 24 hours in a day. And you only work 8 hours a day? And you only work a third of each day. Now, a third of 365 is approximately $121. So you actually only have $121 coming to you?
Yeah. $121?
That's right.
Well, give me the
$121. But you didn't work Sundays, did you?
No.
No, and there's 52 Sundays in a year. So we'll deduct 52 from 121, leaving $69 coming to you.
Well, give me the $69.
But...
What's with the but?
Wait a minute, just a minute. You only worked a half a day on Saturday. Am I right?
Here comes...
So wait a minute. You only worked a half a day on Saturday.
That's all, just half a day.
Okay, now there's 52 Saturdays in a year. Now half of 52 is 26. So we'll deduct 26 from 69... leaving $43 coming to you.
You sure that?
I'm positive.
I mean, I don't want you to cheat yourself.
Well, that's mighty thoughtful of you to look out for my interests.
I might as well look out for yours. You already killed mine. So give me that $43.
But just a minute. You took a vacation, didn't you?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks, that's 14 days. Now, a dollar a day, that's $14. So we'll deduct 14 from 43, leaving the sum of $29 coming to you.
The sum up. If I get some of it, I'll be lucky.
Well, now, wait.
Give me the $29.
But
now I know it as good as you do.
Wait a minute. Just don't get excited. You took time out for lunch, didn't you?
Oh, no, Abbott. Not that. Please don't take that away from me.
Yes.
1 little hour a day. That's all I took.
1 hour a day.
I didn't eat much.
Now, wait a minute.
1 little bit hour.
That's
that big.
That's right. 1 hour a day, 365 days. That's 365 hours. That comes to about 15 days, I take it.
You might as well take it. You've been taking everything else.
So?
15 from 29 is 14, but now I know it better than you do.
Wait a minute. I'm glad I thought of this. Do you know there's 13 holidays in a year that you didn't work?
This is going to cost plenty, too.
Wait a minute. Just a minute. You didn't work those 13 days?
No.
Well, you had $14 coming to you, so we'll deduct 13 from the 14, leaving the exact sum of $1 coming to you.
How do you like that? I'm supposed to get $365, and I wind up with a buck.
Oh, gracias, senor.
This is a fine time to take a nap.
I think that's one of their best routines. And like we discussed, there's only that other one that I saw a couple of years ago on YouTube, on the Ed Sullivan channel, Bud and Lou doing that routine. But it starts off as a domestic scene with Lou and his wife. And his wife is telling him to go get their $365 refund from the tax man, who happens to be Bud. So Lou has to leave the scene and go to Bud's office, and that's how it begins. And again, I told you how uncomfortable it is that they're in a tax office.
Yes, knowing their history. And yeah, not good. No.
A little uncomfortable, slightly uncomfortable. So,
but in essence, that means that this routine almost bookends their career.
You know, you're absolutely their first right. Movie,
and then the Ed Sullivan, that Ed Sullivan appearance, I believe, is one of the last television things. It was. They did,
it was. Mm-hmm. It was. You know how you could tell? You could always tell because Bud's mustache is gone. After the years of him having that mustache, he shaved it off during the last year that they were together. So you know that that's the end, the final routines. But I'm wondering if perhaps maybe they did it in a radio show that we don't know about. Did they do it on the Kate Smith show? You know, I'm thinking it's a probability.
Okay.
Because it's such a great routine. I just don't understand why they didn't do it again. Could it have been one of those situations like Flugel Street? Susquehanna Hats, where Joey Faye claimed ownership and sued Universal and actually got a chunk of change out of them. He copyrighted the routine.
Ah.
Yeah. So I wonder, maybe this.
But then they did that again on their TV show.
Yes, they did. In fact, they just ignored him. I mean, what was he going to do? Keep suing them? You know? There's also doubts whether he wrote it or not. You know, he might have just looked at it and saw that there was no copyright. So I'm going to buy the copyright. But he was a wonderful comedian, Joey Faye.
Well, yes, he was. And, you know, that so much is the case with a lot of that burlesque material. It's almost impossible on some of it to narrow it down to the origin. You know, who originally wrote this, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you listen to Bud Abbott and some of his interviews, I mean, he goes back to like ancient Greece, you know, Greek theater, those jokes and the relationships between the teams and all that. So one of the things that I wanted to mention about this movie, other than the Abbott and Costello aspect, is that in 1940, when this movie was made, it looks incredibly old-fashioned because it's relying on tropes that were... not being done anymore, really. Mm-hmm. You had, it's a goofy screwball comedy kind of setup, but we're talking about stuff that Fred and Ginger stopped doing, you know? they had Eric Rhodes as the Rudolfo, you know, as the threat to Fred Astaire. And this reminds me of, it's trying to be like an old Fred and Ginger movie, right down to the Latin big finale, you know, with a catchy name, the Farandola, you know, instead of the Carioca or, you know, any of those other things that they were doing 5 years before. By this time, Fred and Ginger were doing completely different things. They were doing Castle, you know, the castle, mm-hmm. Vernon and Irene Castle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were jitterbugging at this point. Everybody was jitterbugging. And this was, you know, back to, you know, I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah.
But Alan Jones didn't have that much of a career afterwards. In fact, I'm not sure. I know he did maybe some cameos, but he went back to theater eventually. Mm. And I know that when he was far too old to play Gaylord Ravenel in Showboat, he did revivals for years afterwards because he was in the famous, probably the most popular version of it, the 1936 James Whale version for Universal. But he appeared in one I would have killed to see with Burt Wheeler as Cap'n Andy. Can you imagine doing his dance specialty? You know, I would have loved it. I just would have loved it. You know, I have a couple of connections here. I actually met Alan Jones.
Oh.
1979, the Beach Theater in Miami Beach. He opened for the Ritz Brothers. Now, I was supposed to move to Los Angeles, and I postponed my trip for like 4 months because I knew the Ritz Brothers were coming to Miami. And I lived in South Florida at the time. So I rearranged my schedule so I could go see them every show. They did 5 shows. I was there for all 5 shows. Wow. And who opened for them? Alan Jones, singing, you know, Così Cosa and Alone and even the one he's most famous for, the Donkey Serenade. Right? From a movie called The Firefly, I believe, with Jeanette
McDonald. I think so, yeah.
It was a very ratty theater. It saw better days. Let me put it that way. The audience was never full. It kind of smelled a little off. You know, it was a low budget affair. I think the top ticket was $3.80 or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. But the boys were great. The Ritz Brothers were just fantastic. And I got to know them and I'm backstage and visited with them and all that. Oh. But anyway, with Alan Jones, he set up a little card table in the lobby with cassette tapes that he would sign for you, his merch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just found it a little jarring that this guy I grew up watching in movies, in these big MGM movies, here he was sitting at a little card table hoping somebody bought his cassette, you know? It's weird.
The story that makes me feel that way, I think it was Frank Ferrante was telling about Alan Jones in regards to Night at the Opera. I believe both Night at the Opera and Day at the Races. That Jones had the movies on a tape. Just his scenes.
He cut out all the
good
scenes.
That's it. Yeah. It's only his scenes from those movies.
But you gotta look at this guy and think, you know, I was at MGM. I could sing like a bird. I could do this and that. But all anyone cares about are the other people in the films. Now, that's got to get to you after a while. I know he wasn't happy when I brought up the movies, when I was talking to him. He wasn't thrilled. Maureen O'Sullivan from A Day at the Races, right? Jane from the Tarzan movies. I met her at she did a terrible production of Butterflies Are Free, dinner theater. So I met her afterwards, and I had her sign a picture of her and Groucho. And I got that from her. It's like, why does everybody want me to sign pictures with him? You know, I've had a whole career, you know.
Yeah.
And I felt kind of bad, you know. But so anyway, and then his son, Jack Jones, I hosted a benefit for a symphony orchestra in Thousand Oaks. And he was the guest performer. So I got to introduce him and, you know, play with him a little bit. And afterwards, backstage, we were singing his dad's songs. And he was telling me how much he would love to see a great print of The Boys from Syracuse. Mm. And I tried, but I just couldn't find one. I think it's tied up in litigation, like Hell's a Poppin' was that way too. Yeah. So anyway, there we are. It's a very old-fashioned film. Even the people in it had seen better days. Like I mentioned, Mary Boland was actually on her way down as far as films. I know she did stage and all that. Alan Jones really didn't. It was back to the stage for him. Peggy Moran, like I said, only made like 9 movies before she married Henry Koster, the director. Nancy Kelly had a long career and a long life. I remember her most of all from The Bad Seed with Patty McCormick as the little girl that you wanted to strangle. She played the mother and a very distraught performance. Something. But that's what I remember her from most of all. Oscar Hammerstein II wrote the lyrics to one of the songs. So you had the two songwriters from Showboat working on this film. And I enjoyed it. I watched it again last night. I gave it every chance. I paid full attention to it. And I enjoyed it. I can't say it's my favorite Abbott and Costello movie. I can't even say it's my favorite musical, you know, from 1940. But it is a lot of fun. And everybody's doing their best. And Bill Frawley gives a really nice performance. And as I watch, and this is another thing I wanted to ask you, Jerry, is as I'm watching Alan Jones on screen. I mean, we all grew up with Robert Cummings and his TV shows and all that stuff. But a real piece of work, by the way. I knew his son, Tony, and it was not pretty. He was not he was one of the customers of Dr. Feelgood. I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. Ooh. Feelgood. Yeah, yes. He used to supply celebrities, including our President Kennedy, with mind-altering drugs. But yeah, Robert Cummings wanted to live forever and be young forever, and turned out to be kind of sad. What was I saying before that? I keep going in 80 different directions. I don't know who I am. Who am I for crying out loud? Well, Hildy, this is the paper. You've got to consider the paper. Sorry.
Okay.
I watched that Cary Grant movie.
For those of you who had episode 2 for when Nick would pull out his Cary Grant imitation, you win. All right. I'm not sure where you were coming from, but I did want to say I've always enjoyed Robert Cummings. I really like him in this movie.
Yeah,
because he does that, you know, bumbling, fumbling, innocent sort of a thing so well.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's so young. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And one more thing I wanted to mention for Marx Brother fans. We mentioned the Coconuts earlier. The main villain in the Coconuts was Harvey Yates. Remember Harvey Yates?
Mm-hmm.
And he was an actor by the name of Cyril Ring. And to be honest with you, Harvey Yates was probably the last large role he had in a movie because he's usually unbilled and has no dialogue. But in this movie, he has at least two lines that he deals with. He's the maitre d' that deals with William Frawley, sign this check, you know, whatever. So it was good to see Cyril Ring get a little play there, you know?
And indeed, indeed.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so One Night in the Tropics comes out. They decide to open it in Paterson, New Jersey.
Wow.
Yeah, Universal heard that the boys were going to go back there anyway to do a benefit for Lou's old church, the St. Anthony's in Paterson, New Jersey. So they came up with the idea to make the premiere a benefit for the church. And nobody got paid. And yeah, everything went to the church. They put on a whole new section and all that. It was a big success. Lou was definitely Paterson's major boy. He was their boy. And one more piece of trivia, fascinating to me. Charles Frohman was a very, very big producer in England. He was probably you can compare him to like Ziegfeld or that kind of stature. And in 1915, Jerome Kern and Charles Frohman were talking about a production in London, and they were going to take the ship to London together. It was the Lusitania. Ooh. And because of a late night poker game, Jerome Kern missed the boat. Charles Frohman went down with the boat.
Wow.
There's your tragic trivia when it comes to Jerome Kern. How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. From no boat to showboat, you might say. Or not.
And now you know the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. Oh, God. So, yeah, so that's it. I mean, I don't know what else we can say about this film. It was not supposed to be known as the first Abbott and Costello movie. It was supposed to be a big hit musical for Universal that Abbott and Costello just happened to be in. So what happens? The reviews come out. The boys are singled out. The critics are falling all over themselves, saying this is the only jolly point of the film. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. In fact, yeah, Time Magazine. I came across this and it just struck me as wonderful. In Time Magazine's review of the film, they're talking about Bud and Lou. It says that they saved the picture from general tediousness.
There you go. See?
Sums it up.
General tediousness. They're already talking about the war. But anyway, yeah, they got the reviews. They were the saviors of the film, such as it was. So Universal called them in and signed them to a two-picture deal, the first one of which we are going to be discussing in episode 3 next month. And that, of course, is Buck Privates. There's interesting negotiation stories for these first two films that I think we'll get into next month as we talk about them. And in the meantime, what do you think, Jerry? Recommend it. I think I can recommend this movie. If you have access to it, it's actually on YouTube for free. One Night in the Tropics.
I did not know that. I've got the box set, the Universal films. You know, it's the first one on it. Really good quality transfer on the
Yeah, movie. I watched the Blu-ray. I watched the Blu-ray last night. It was really beautiful. So yeah, if you want to see it, it's on YouTube and you could judge for yourself. And in the meantime, I want to wish you all a wonderful February and we will see you in March as we march on with more Abbott and Costello fun. I love these segues. Aren't they? These segues are good, aren't they? It's starting to sound
like
Papa.
You are the king of the segues. You really are.
All right. All right. And maybe we'll have another visit to the Bud Abbott variety show in the next episode. We'll see who the next guest is.
Yeah, you're going to have to go a long way to top Burt Mustin. I can tell you that right now. But
that's just a name that sounds old. burnt yes. mustard. You know, I've got to clean that mustard. anyway, folks, from my pal Jerry and myself, we want to wish you all the best, good health, and please try to remember, mustard goes with the hot dog.
Hot dog. Give me a hot dog, too. What time's the floor show starting?
Shh, quiet, please, quiet.
No floor show, huh?
No floor show.
Oh, thanks a lot, kid.
There you are. There you are, boy.
No, I don't eat mustard, kid.
Yeah. Mustard goes with the hot dog.
Yeah, well, not with mine. I eat a plain.
Mustard was made for the hot dog.
Look, I don't care what it's made for. I'm not going to eat it. I don't like it.
Oh, well, that's
do I have to eat something I don't like?
No, I didn't know that.
I mean, after all, I don't want to go around eating something that's going to make me sick.
Well, I didn't know
mustard
that.
Mustard makes me sick.
Well, then you shouldn't eat it.
I mean, after all, I'm a happy kid. I got a lot to live for.
I know that, Lou.
I don't want to walk around the street sick.
All right, now, don't
care. If I eat mustard and I walk around the street sick, I can't get a job. What happens to my wife and kids?
What do you mean?
Yeah, I got a wife and two children.
Well, what about it?
My kids wind up in the orphan asylum.
Now, behave yourself.
You're a fine guy sending my kids to an orphan asylum.
Who's sending who where?
What am I kids ever do to you?
Nothing at all.
What right you got to put them away in the orphan asylum?
You know what you're
after
saying?
After all, I'm able to support them children. You got no right to put them away.
Don't get excited.
Come on, get my kids out of the orphan asylum.
Now, wait a minute. What started all this?
Mustard.
Well, I mean, it's there if you want it.
Well, you can take it away. I don't want it.
Listen, what I'm trying to convey to you is that the hot dog and the mustard go together.
Let them go together. I don't want to spoil any romance.
Oh, talk sense.
Well, I don't like it.
So you don't like it?
I like Worcestershire, sure, George.
You what?
Worcestershire, sure, George.
Worcestershire, shire, shire, shosh.
You can't even say it.
But you don't like mustard.
No, I don't care.
Give me a reason. Who are you that you shouldn't like mustard? What are you, some big shot or something? Too big a guy to like mustard?
What did mustard ever do for me?
I'll be.
Why should I throw myself out on account of mustard? Mustard any better than I am? Go on, pick your friends. What do you want, me or mustard?
Now, wait a minute.
Go ahead, take mustard.
Just a minute. Do you know where mustard comes from?
I know they don't scrape it off a mustard plaster.
Certainly not. They manufacture mustard. Do you know they spend millions of dollars every year to put up factories just to manufacture mustard? Do you know those factories employ thousands and thousands of men just to manufacture mustard? Do you know those men take care of thousands of families and homes all on account of mustard? And you, just because you don't like mustard, what do you want them to do? Close those factories down and put all those people out of work?
Wait a minute. Do you mean to stand there and tell me just because I don't eat mustard, I'm closing down the mustard factories?
Now, wait a minute.
Are you trying to tell me that those thousands of people are making one little jar of mustard just for me?
Oh, I'll explain
if that. If they are, you can tell them not to make any more because I'm not going to eat it.
All right, forget about
you
it.
You can lay them off.
Sure.
Who am I to support thousands?
Oh, why stand here and argue with you?